Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show. This is your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I'm joined this morning by my fellow co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Julie. Tuesday already.
It is, and you've been away.
Yeah, I did. I got back last night about 2:30 a.m. It was touch and go.
And have you been up all night? Are we catching you with no sleep, Phil?
No, about 3 hours.
All right. Well, very good. And are you going to tell us a little bit about where you've been?
Well, it was my 40th high school class reunion, which if no one's gone to a reunion of that era, it's great. You'll remember things that never happened, and things that did, you'll find out you forgot. So you can reinvent your past.
Oh, very good. And did folks recognize you after all these years?
Some did. And surprisingly, some folks recognized me that I didn't recognize.
That can happen. That can very much happen. Well, welcome back. I'm glad that you're here. It snowed since you've been away. Maybe you noticed that.
I know. So did you transition to the ice fishing?
Not for me. I'm not an ice fishing person. So no.
Well, great for some early season tracking, animal tracking.
That's for sure. Well, let's just talk about the weather for a moment, and then we'll introduce our guest for this morning's morning show, which is folks that used to be part of the River Journal. But for now, we'll talk about the weather. Today, we can expect mostly clear skies. Last night, we had a low around 15. Today, we're expecting a high of around 33 with patchy freezing fog, then mostly sunny. You may have noticed that if you've been driving around this morning. Tonight, we're looking at mostly cloudy, a low of 22, so it's getting chilly. And then tomorrow, Wednesday, a high of 36, and there's a slight chance of snow. But Wednesday night and Thursday, looking at another good chance of snow, a low of 28, high of 38, and 60% chance of rain or snow. So we're going away from our sunny days back into the snow, Phil.
We've transitioned straight to winter somehow. I'm rooting for fall to return, even briefly.
So am I. I had a little bit of late fall mushrooming, and then it snowed on all my mushrooms. Darn it.
Well, this is an exciting show today. The River Journal was one of the things when I first moved here in 2002 that was really appealing about the area, and I think helped to define for me what it meant to be in North Idaho and northwestern Montana. And although this will be a somewhat nostalgic show, we're excited to have folks who were really integral to the River Journal over its years, Trish Gannon, the publisher, and Ernie Hawks, and Sandy Compton. And we'll let each of them tell their association with the River Journal. Trish, why don't we start with you and tell our listeners who might not know the magazine a little bit about what it's about and how you came to be involved.
Well, the River Journal started back in December of 1993, and it was mostly based in Montana, but it also covered Hope and Clark Fork. And I lived in Clark Fork and became involved in early 94, writing stories about school issues, because I was pretty involved with school issues at the time. I was started by Dennis Nichols, who was a forester and thought that as he got older, he might not want to have to work in the woods anymore, and thought newspaper publishing would be a good field to go into. I think he changed his mind eventually about that. So
I think there's a lot of stories. We're going to get to those pretty quickly about that. I can see Sandy just shaking his head.
Anyway, that's how I got involved. Stayed with Dennis throughout the ups and downs of the River Journal, and then when he finally decided to quit in 2001, I took it over and kept publishing it until August this year was our last issue. So 23 years. We had a pretty good run, I think.
And I noticed you didn't say you bought it. You probably paid the debt off to take it over.
Definitely the debt to me. Some of the other debt as well, but.
So let's swing around. Ernie, tell us a little bit about how you came to be involved with the River Journal and your history with it.
Well, I was working out at the Co-op Country Store in Ponderay and met Trish there because I was doing the advertising for them and met Trish through that. And in 2001, when she said that she was planning on taking over the River Journal, we talked about it and talked about my job and her job and so on, and thought it would be kind of a good fit and fun to move over to the River Journal. So so I started with the River Journal the 1st of September of 2001, and the day before the first print of after I started was 9/11, which changed everything, of course, for that print and put it off for a couple of days also.
Now, and Ernie, I know you as a contributor, but you had another job there?
At the River Journal?
Yes.
Well, I tried selling advertising for doing that, and I was the arts and entertainment editor for a while because I have a background in the performing arts and stuff, and so that's kind of another connection to it worked well for me.
Don't forget delivery boy, because everybody was a delivery boy as well.
Delivery boy and janitor, yeah.
And Mr. Compton.
Well, somewhere between when Dennis and Trish got started and the time that I got involved, Dennis came to his senses and quit doing the River Journal for about a year. And we met, and he knew that I was in the publishing writing business, and he wanted my advice about what to do about restarting the River Journal. And I said, dig a hole, put all your ideas into it, and cover up the hole and put rocks on top of it. And I found out from that experience that if you wanted Dennis to do something, it was like leading a cow that didn't want to go in the direction that you wanted it to go. You would pull it in the opposite direction, and then Dennis would go completely opposite of what you just told him to do. So he goes, oh, well, then I'm going to start the River Journal again. I went, you want to help? And I said, okay, I'll help. But this is how I'm going to help. I get to write a column for every issue, and I get to write anything I want. He goes, oh, okay. And that's how I started writing for my first column in the River Journal was January of 1997. Mm-hmm. And I missed one because the slacker publisher forgot to tell me it was the deadline again. after she had told me it was deadline a couple times already. But it was the second to the last one that I missed. That's the only River Journal that I did not write for.
That's an amazing record.
I think a lot of local folks would recognize your column, but it went by a special name that kind of framed everything up for you.
The Scenic Route. Yeah. I actually made a book out of them after a while.
So there's a whole lot more we can go into with Dennis and the transition. But before the show, we were talking a little bit about, I think even before Trish got here, Dennis's association with what kept him going.
Stubbornness.
he was a little bit crazy.
And stubborn.
Yeah.
I'm getting the sense that this was not an easy publication to keep going, and you all put in a lot of effort to get it out each issue, because it was certainly a great journal. I enjoyed reading it, and y'all put a lot of effort in. I loved the articles.
Well, actually, it's like I'd actually like to say one of those four-letter words right now that I'm not supposed to say, because it was the River Journal was a struggle from the very beginning, and it continued to be a struggle until Trish came to her senses finally here a couple months ago and decided that she wasn't going to do it anymore. Labor of love. There was always a great deal of hope and optimism that we were finally going to break into a place where we might even get paid. And so, you know, after, 20 years, 21 years or so, 23 for you, and
16 or 17
for Ernie, we finally came to the conclusion that we probably weren't going to get paid. So... It was an interesting ride. There was some really interesting up and down stuff. We decided in the middle of things to do a weekly in Sandpoint, which I can't even remember the name of.
Sandpoint Sunday.
And Trish, were you involved at that time?
Oh, yeah. I remember the Sandpoint Sunday. Sandy had this brilliant idea that we were going to do this Sunday newspaper for...
Sandpoint. It was Dennis. Dennis's idea completely.
And Sandy thought it wouldn't be a problem if we just hand delivered it to everybody. So I remember getting lost somewhere in Hope, somewhere way up in the mountains in Hope, throwing newspapers in people's driveways at about 7 o'clock in the morning. It was an interesting 6 week run for the Sandpoint Sunday.
Did you remember to put them in plastic bags before you threw them in the driveway?
Yeah, of course I did.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the reach. At its inception, you might have been able to hand deliver it, but towards its end, its zenith, it reached a large number of communities.
Well, I think at its zenith probably was back around 2001. It was when we were still direct mailing it. And the direct mail at that time was about 17,000 copies, I think it was.
And then it was available at how many newsstands or places, locations?
Well, I used to say that, and especially when we quit direct mailing, that it was available in two states. Was it four counties, and 33 communities?
My.
So it did go a lot of places. And sometimes it surprised us to find out where it would end up. I remember getting a call one time. I had written a story about girls doing science at Clark Fork, because Clark Fork does science very, very well. And got a phone call from, it wasn't from the Department of Education. It was another federal department in the government congratulating me on the story. And you sit there and wonder, how did you even find it? But they did.
And was it what would you say led to the demise of the journal? Was it just diminishing advertisers?
I think there were probably, it was probably like the death of a thousand cuts more than anything else. My life had changed pretty substantially in the last couple of years. My mother died. My brother died. Dennis was gone. I think we were all struggling with dealing with the changes in our community and how we felt about that and how we wanted to write about that. And of course, there was never any money, you know, so it wasn't like there was money that was an incentive to keep doing it. It was just an awful lot of work.
And the publication business, the news business, newspapers in particular, have really changed dramatically in the last decade or so.
We'd call it burnout.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking there was an energy shortage there the last
like flaming in about 1,000 miles an hour into the sun.
Well, and as you get older, you do discover that there really is not enough alcohol to do everything you think you might want to do.
So if you're just tuning in, this is listener-supported radio for North Idaho, 88.5 KRFY FM in Ponderay. We're speaking this morning with the former publisher of the former River Journal, Trish Gannon, and two of its mainstays over the decades, Sandy Compton and Ernie Hawks. Ernie, tell us a little bit more about how you saw the whole progress of the publication.
Well, when I started, we were still printing over in Ronan, Montana. And so we were talking about distribution a little while ago. As I, part of my job was to go to Montana and get the paper printed and bring it back. And on the way back, I would start delivering it in Paradise and deliver it all the way down the Clark Fork Valley until it got to Sandpoint. And then we would pass it on, and some people took it to Bonner's Ferry. Some people took it over to Priest River area. Some of us took it down to the Coeur d'Alene area and Athol area, where I'm from, the Athol area where I'm from. And then my wife was going into North Idaho College every day, and so she took it clear on down there for us. So we had it was really from Canada to Coeur d'Alene and clear across the state of the Panhandle, clear across the Panhandle and into Montana. And it was a struggle. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of hours, and it was a lot of fun too. You know, we had a lot of fun together, I felt like. I would stop in and hassle Sandy as I was coming back down the river sometimes, you know. And I would, a lot of times I would, back then we weren't sending the paper to the printer via the internet. We were actually carrying the glued pages over there in the morning. And so I would meet Trish at, oh gosh, what was it? It'd be like 4 in the morning in Clark Fork, which is an hour from my home. And so, and then drive from there over to Ronan with it. So it was quite a stretch. You know.
I think that one of the brilliances of the River Journal, though, is within that fairly large geographic area, there is a center, and Sandy writes this in some of his columns, that emotional center, which really is the Clark Fork River as it meets the Ponderay, and whether it's defined by the mountains and lake that are there or the folks who settle into it, there is a center at which Sandy's written about the From Hope to Paradise, and it's more than a physical description. Why don't we, Sandy, talk about that emotional center framing of the River Journal.
Well, Dennis's vision was that the River Journal would run from basically from where the Flathead and the Clark Fork come together just east of Paradise all the way to Newport. And to cover that geographic drainage of the Clark Fork River and the Lake Ponderay, that's why he named it the River Journal. For a period of time, Dennis tried to report on every sports team, which really was why Dennis started the newspaper in the first place, because he loved high school sports. And he tried to cover every sports team between Paradise and Newport in some manner or another. He traveled up and down. He had this old beater SLR that probably weighed more than my car, and it just, he would take pictures and talk to kids and write stories about, like, little short stories about who won this. And he did that for about 3 years, that just, he tried to cover every sports team. And that was also his marketing plan. He figured the more sports teams he mentioned, that the more people would be interested in the magazine or in the newspaper at that time.
We love to see our kids in print.
The newspaper has undergone a huge number of physical changes in the time of its existence. It started out as a broadsheet, basically, that was printed out on a dot matrix printer and glued into place on blue lines, mm-hmm. and carried off, as Ernie talks about, going to Ronan, which was always an adventure because the newspaper always got done about 2:30 in the morning. And the press run was set up to go like at 7 in the morning, so you had to be there. You'd take this big box of paper that had been glued in place with these little dot pictures of the old-fashioned stuff, and you'd take it there, and they'd take pictures of it and turn it into a newspaper. And it was a pretty crazy time. And although the print production world has been revolutionized since then. Trish, at the end of the thing, was pushing a button that sent the PDF files to Spokane and then would drive down there and get the newspaper, you know, about 10 hours later.
It's still hand-deliver them to every subscriber along the way back.
Well, that was a problem. It's hard to get subscribers for a free newspaper.
Sure.
You know, that whole going to Ronan to print, there are so many good memories involved in that, or funny memories involved in that. I recall one time driving out to Ronan with Dennis sleeping in the passenger seat, and somewhere out by the bison range, I hit a goose. Oh. And you know, or it hit me is how I felt. Flew right in front of my windshield and made this horrendous bang, and Dennis jumped up awake and he said, What is it? And I said, oh, no, I've hit a goose. And I was almost in tears, and he just looked at me, and he said, oh, you know they mate for life, don't you? I'll never forget that morning going out there. But I think actually Ernie has the best story about an interesting trip out to Ronan with the paper.
The last one?
Yeah.
The Ronan Printing Company was purchased by another publishing company. And we knew that had happened, and we were kind of wondering if we were going to stay with them at that point anyway. But so I did, as I mentioned earlier, I met Trish at like 4 in the morning, which meant leaving my place like at 3. Drove over to Ronan, which is about a 3-hour drive, got there about 6:30 Montana time, and the place wasn't there. The building was there. The doors were locked. Any sign of a publishing company was out of all the windows and everything. So I called Trish, and for some reason, my cell phone had about 2 minutes left on the battery. And so I called Trish and said, it's not here, and I don't know what's up. And so Trish started making phone calls. And I was out of battery on my cell phone, so I called her on a fest. You could still find pay phones back then. And so I called her on a pay phone, and she said, someone's going to meet you there, and they're going to figure out what to do about this. And so someone did come down and meet me, and so I followed them up to Columbia Falls, where there was a print shop up there. and drove up there and hung out in Columbia Falls while they squeezed our publication in, literally squeezed it in because they had not scheduled it at all up there. And so I was up there for 4 or 5 hours and then started back from Columbia Falls back to my route, which was down to Paradise and back down the valley. Anyway, altogether, I had driven over 500 miles that day to get the paper delivered.
Well, those
it was a crazy time, but it actually turned out really well because as I was making the phone calls trying to find out who was permanently going to print the River Journal, Griffin Publishing had just opened and started business like 2 months before that happened. And and we ended up with Griffin, which I think is one of the finest printers in the area. So it wasn't all bad news, especially as Ernie was the one doing the driving.
Well, it's many interesting tales of getting the paper out, and I can understand now why it's such a labor of love. I'm interested in hearing about how you came to have so many interesting columnists. It must have been not so many in the beginning, but by the end, it seemed like every article was so unusual and sometimes quirky.
They all had the same deal that I had. They can write anything they want.
Did they truly? That
was we really did. We could write about, like, especially on our columns.
And sometimes they even ran spell check on them.
I think most of the time we ran spell check on them. That was something we were pretty picky about. I think they're failing to recognize what a gift I have for recognizing the most interesting people in this area. And it's one thing I'm really proud of is that almost all of the finest writers around at some time or another wrote for the River Journal. It was one of the great blessings of the River Journal is that so many talented people actually came and wrote for us.
And one of the things I loved about it personally was the great diversity. You had a pretty wide set of viewpoints running the political spectrum, but also the topical spectrum of what makes our communities unique, from the association with the outdoors to education, community issues. It was a great paper that covered a lot of things.
It was a lot of great people. We started doing Christmas parties, and they were always a blast because it really was this diverse crowd of people coming together and enjoying each other and enjoying what it was that we put out together.
Were there any favorite columnists? Of course, excepting for the two in the room being at the very top.
Well, Dennis was always my favorite columnist. You know, he had a wonderful romantic style of writing about the outdoors that is not in my toolbox whatsoever, and I just loved what he always had to write. But if I started, I'd never end listing them. You know, J.J. Scott wrote about fish and game issues. I miss JJ a lot. He was replaced by Matt Haig. Matt was just a wonderful writer. I mean, I could go through, you know, the next hour telling you about the wonderful people.
Well, I would like you to go through some of the interesting people, but in the meantime, we'll take a short song break. We'll think about who are our most interesting writers that we'd like to discuss, and then we'll be back. For those of you just joining us, you are at 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio for the Idaho Panhandle. If you don't hear all of the program this morning, you'll be able to catch it as a podcast. And that was Paul Simon with Rewrite. An appropriate song for this morning, Phil?
It is. And I think, and we'll get to it a little bit about how often maybe Trish had to rewrite things that people had submitted. Anyway, welcome back to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio for North Idaho. This morning, we're talking with River Journal folks, Trish Gannon, Sandy Compton, Ernie Hawks. We are going to pick up the thread about columnists. And I know every time I picked up a River Journal after reading the lead article plastered on the front page, I'd turn it open to the scenic route. Always one of my favorites, Sandy. Tell us about that column.
Well, scenic route grew out of, I came back from Nevada about a billion years ago. I went to work for a little newspaper called the Bonner News Digest, which was a weekly, and I started writing a column called The Top of My Desk And again, I was writing anything I wanted to and getting paid about the same amount that I got paid for the River Journal. But that thing died, and then Dennis wanted to restart. So the scenic route is the road from Sandpoint to Paradise. And one of the columns that I wrote, as a matter of fact, was life on the road between hope and paradise. And so I would write about lots of different aspects of that drive, about the lake, about the river, about country living. And then every once in a while, like every other one, I'd go on some somewhat liberal rant about the condition of our country and what we might do about it. And I actually was accused one time of having opinions and in a blog post that somebody did on something that I wrote online.
Do I understand right? At some point, there was a general agreement between you and Trish about who would rant which issue?
Yeah, we took turns for a while, and then once in a while we just both rant, and then once in a while neither one of us would rant. So it kept it interesting, I'm sure. Ernie didn't rant quite as often as we did, but I don't know if you ever really ranted. You were more a little gentler.
There was one time. Actually, I had a couple of rants, short ones. There was one after. Man at the festival got up and I agreed with him, but I didn't agree with what he did. And he stood up there and yelled "Anyone but Bush" during the Bush campaign, the second Bush campaign. And of course, everything broke loose in the audience, and there were people that were very angry from both sides and everything. And so what I wrote about was, yeah, I agreed with him in his freedom to speak. And I felt that he was in the wrong venue and the wrong place to do that. And the reaction from a lot of the people was inappropriate. I mean, there was borderline violence there.
Ernie, back up for a moment and tell us about your column for those that maybe didn't read it often.
The Hawk's Nest was my column, and it was just kind of about stuff that I did, a lot of stuff that I did. That was actually a column. That rant that I just talked about was actually in a column. And it ranged from sometimes trying to be humorous to my hiking and my travels around the world, for that matter, and also to a lot of family stuff. As we first started this thing, my mother was on the slippery slope for the first couple of years of it and did, in fact, pass. And so I had a few columns about dealing with that issue, and it was kind of healing for me to get to deal with it that way, you know. And I had a lot of fun reliving a lot of fun things that I've got to do in my life, hiking and places I've got to visit in Italy and Hawaii and different places like that.
So. The River Journal is always a place for personal voice. Dennis
for
wrote.
Sure.
Dennis mm-hmm. wrote a column called The Blue Penciler. That was his experience of living. The Scenic Route is my experience of living, Ernie's column. And then Trish.
Trish, tell us. Tell us what you wrote about.
Well, you know, I wrote most of the news stories, but I also had a column. It was called Politically Incorrect because I've been described like that many, many times. At the time, I didn't have television. I didn't know about Bill Maher. Didn't know anybody else had ever used that name. But we had so many great columnists. You know, Boots Reynolds, I don't know if you knew Boots, Julie, but he was the internationally acclaimed cowboy artist. And you can see his pictures all over town. And when I ran into him at All Seasons Garden Center, and he told me he would like to write a column for the River Journal. And Boots was not a writer. Boots was a good storyteller. But he wasn't always sure how to string a sentence together, and he certainly didn't know how to spell most of the words that he used. And So there was a little bit of interpretation that had to go on every month when Boots's column would come in to try to figure out just exactly what we thought he was trying to say. Great, great stories, though. And then on the other hand, we had Marianne Love, you know, who's a well-known local storyteller. She's got a blog, Slight Detour, that she maintains every day. She's still telling stories about this community. And you know, Marianne was a former English teacher, so you could count on getting something very, very clean from her. One time, for some reason, I got a column from her that did have a lot of typographical errors in it, and so I blew it up really big and framed it for her Christmas present.
And did you take the red pencil to it?
Marianne also was the publisher of one of the more successful newspapers in Bonner County. She was the Cedar Post advisor for all of the time that she was at Sandpoint High School. So she understood the newspaper business.
I also really enjoyed Gary Payton's Faith Walk.
Both Gary Payton and Kathy Osborne, who's out at the co-op, agreed to write these Faith Walk columns for me to represent the spiritual aspect of life in North Idaho. And, you know, people tend to be fairly spiritual creatures, and I think they were fairly well-received columns for that.
So were there any... Go ahead, Ernie.
Those Faith Walk columns, I think, is one thing that really kind of describes Trish as a publisher, because they also took something that's a lot of times kind of controversial. I mean, anytime you start talking about spirit or religion or anything like that, and Trish just let them run with it any way they wanted to, and their interpretations of it. And I think that's a real tribute to Trish and the magazine.
The interesting thing about the two Faith Walk writers was they had very different approaches to a relationship with the spirit. Amazingly different, like almost diametrically opposed. But it was interesting to watch that back and forth, because they took turns. Gary would write for 1 month, and then Kathy would write for the next month. So,
and Trish, Sandy. I'm wondering, Trish, did the writers come to you? Did you seek them out? How did they come to be in the journal?
Usually, for the most part, I sought them out. Every night, we had a couple that came to me, but normally I would find out somehow that either somebody was a good writer or just somebody was very interesting, and I would encourage them to write, and that's how they ended up with us. I would like to mention one other columnist that I know had a big following with a lot of people, was my brother Jody Forrest, who right. died 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Joe wrote a variety of columns for the River Journal. He wrote about Veterans Affairs for a long time, but he wrote, I'm trying to think of how to describe it now, because it uses one of those four-letter words I can't say. The weird stuff.
Yeah,
I always called him, you know, he wrote the weird stuff column, and it was, he named it the Surrealist Research Bureau. But people love that. I've had a number of comments from people, you know, even recently, telling me how much they miss those stories.
That was always interesting and entertaining. Mm-hmm. His and Scott Clausen's.
Scott Clausen's another real good one that comes from.
And absolutely hilarious.
Absolutely, yeah. I kind of feel like I got to bring Scott in a way, because he's a Kerrywood guy. He's a neighbor of mine. And so Trish and I were talking about possible cartoonists at the time, and I knew about Scott. And so I got the two of them together, and talk about a marriage made in heaven. I mean, it was just fantastic.
And I think that brings us to a good topic. As a magazine, as a newspaper, the River Journal is always extremely visually compelling. The number of photographs and artwork that were to be found in it really exceeded expectations for a local newspaper.
I really hope that Laura Wall is out there listening to that right now. Laura's the designer for Sandpoint Magazine, and I will say that she taught me everything I knew about design, but she would not want to take responsibility for that.
And so she designed the River Journal.
No.
She didn't.
No, but everything I learned about good design, I learned from peeking over her shoulder as she was doing Sandpoint Magazine.
And I think Trish is being a little modest, too. I know you labored over a lot of times the cover photograph, and I remember often trying to connect you with
the
photos.
Cover. I hated the cover photograph. I hated trying to figure out what the cover was going to be.
Except the three covers I provided for you, of course.
As a user, though, we loved your role in that and the results.
Well, thank you.
We redesigned the River Journal a number of times. Finally went to the magazine format, about 4 years ago?
2006.
Oh, my God. So 11 years ago, we went to the magazine format. Yeah. But the River Journal was, as I say, the beginning was a broadsheet, and then went to a tabloid, which stayed a tabloid for a long time. The artwork for the cover, the River Journal logo, if you will, was designed by
Pam Van Kirk.
Yes, and it is really about the only thing that has survived all of the changes. And we've done a whole bunch of different things with that. We've brought it into Photoshop and created outlines and colored it differently. But the River Journal, that very distinctive banner, has survived pretty nicely. It's been transferred from one style to another.
Mm-hmm. And who supplied most of the artwork or photography? Was it a group of regulars or not?
Everybody that had anything to do with it.
Anybody with a camera.
Plus Wikipedia.
Especially when online, that banner always, for some reason, reminded me of the Grateful Dead. There was some kind of influence.
Oh,
there,
you knew,
I'm sure.
Pam. Yeah.
Exactly.
Many influences going on there. So... we brought up the topic of rewrite with the song, and I do want to know, were there any memorable columns you had to either rewrite or reject?
I had a cartoonist at one time who submitted a political cartoon on the same subject that they'd done their previous cartoon on. It was opposing a candidate in an election, and this issue was coming out right before the election, and I rejected that cartoon, and the cartoonist quit. I think that's the only thing. I ever rejected. I never had to do heavy rewrites on anybody. I certainly fixed a lot of spelling errors and made grammatical corrections. But pretty much what you read was the story they intended to tell.
My goal with each column was that I would always write to, my column was always 800 words for about probably 15 of the 20 years that I wrote. My column was 800 words, and I would write 1,000 words, and then I would cut 200, and then I would send it to Trish. And every once in a while, there'd be some little dingy thing in there, but it was pretty much got printed just like I sent it.
So she really did keep her promise of letting you write what you wanted.
It was
both
either that
you.
Or I didn't write anymore.
There you go.
I think from what I understand or remember too, Trish was more of a taskmaster with deadlines than Dennis perhaps.
Well, we actually started hitting deadlines after Trish came. After Trish came back. She was gone for a little while. And I remember, this is terrible, I remember like Dennis is saying, I want to hire Trish Gannon to come do this and that. I go, man, we're not making enough money to hire anybody. He goes, and he did it anyway, of course. And I should have said, oh, yeah, do it. And then Trish would have been saved like 20 years of misery.
Oh,
Trish, I'm not sure that's totally true, but I do remember for a brief period of time, Dennis had hired Dick Wentz. Dick Wentz to come work with the River Journal, and Dick was going to sell advertising, which was interesting. I remember the first ad he sold, he was so excited. He came in and told me, he said, hey, I sold this ad to so-and-so. And I said, great. I said, what size is it? He says, I don't know. I said, well, what do they want to have in it? I don't know. So he had a steep learning curve in selling ads for the River Journal. But poor Dick and I used to sit down. Sandy was there in the office. We were over there, the old Critter Corral that ended up being Zach Hagedorn's house after we had it for a River Journal office. And Dick and I used to go out to lunch together, and we'd ask each other, he said, so do you get paid? No. Did you get paid? No.
Oh.
We would commiserate all the time. No, I haven't been paid in quite a while.
Obviously, the publication for many was a labor of love. But over the years with that, any favorite editions, anything you were really particularly proud of? This has the markings of what I want the paper to be.
Honestly, I think I was proud of all of them. You know, my dad used to always say, he's don't put your name on something you can't be proud of, and he said that quite frequently, and I think for the most part every River Journal that went out, you know, there were certainly things that could have been done better I was pretty happy with everyone that went out.
Well, as we run short on time, I do have a final question for y'all. And the question is, we're taking a hiatus from the River Journal at this time, and I understand there's been one in the past. Is there any chance we might see a revitalization of the River Journal, or is it really?
Well, if there's any millionaires out there who would like to fund a never-make-a-profit newspaper, no, probably not. I mean,
even then.
Oh,
there are projects in the work to get the old issues online. There was a lot of good stuff there, but no, I have no intention of going.
There has been an online presence, so it's comforting to hear that perhaps the online presence will continue with the archival.
Yeah, in fact, I have a check in my pocket right now if I get by to Keoki Publishing and pay for the web hosting for another year.
Oh, good. And so, as we wrap up, just some short last thoughts from Sandy and Ernie.
Never say never. That's one thing. The River Journal has been like has risen out of the depths of death before, and not just once. There are a number of times when we all said, we're not going to do this, and then next week we go, oh, well, I guess maybe we will. But the River Journal name is pretty well known, and I think that there's might be a place for it someplace in the world yet.
Are you saying there's hope?
Somewhere between hope and paradise. Yeah.
The old joke that the way to make a small fortune in publishing the River Journal is to start with a large one.
All right.
Well, we want to thank you all for coming in today and sharing your stories with us.
My pleasure.
There may be like a round two if we need another show, but always look forward to hearing from each of you on any of the projects you're working on as your work does continue forward. And thank you, Trish and Sandy and Ernie, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes, and KRFY is not letting you go, are we? We've got you back.
As a reminder, too, if you caught part of the show and want to hear it all, we do put up as podcasts our interviews at www.krfy. Art Garfunkel with The Waters of March, the title track to that album. It seems to make sense to put a little Art Garfunkel with the earlier Paul Simon. They were, however, you know, together forever.
For some time.
Yeah. Julie, tell us about the other upcoming morning shows this week.
I will be happy to. So tomorrow, I hope you'll join us for the morning show at 8 a.m., and that would be with hosts Chris Bessler and Susie Prez, who will review the results of the city council election, which, as you should know, is today. So if you folks are eligible to vote in Sandpoint, I hope you'll get out there and vote. As a second interview, they will be interviewing organizers of the upcoming Farmers Holiday Market. That would, again, be tomorrow morning, Wednesday at 8 a.m. And if you like easy listening music before that, please tune in. You'll hear Bernie Mosier with his morning show. Thursday, join the morning show hosts Jack Peterson and Jim Healy and their guest Madeline Elliott from the Unknown Locals and their involvement in Thoreau, Ballad of Walden. And again, that would be Thursday morning at 8 a.m.
Yeah, that should be a good one, too, because the Thoreau presentation is coming up real soon.
Yes.
Next Tuesday on our morning show, we'll have Denison Webb, the executive director and founder of SOUL, Selkirk Outdoor Leadership and Education, and his new program, Director Jamie, they're going to be talking about upcoming winter programming at SOUL, the snowshoe, and I believe they have several events coming up, too, that are really high-powered.
I always look forward to hearing what's happening with SOUL. They're a great organization.
Film festivals, they always bring in some really, really wonderful films. Today is election day everywhere, and here locally, city council races, and also for the local fire districts.
Yes, yeah, so get out and vote, everyone. How many times can I say it?
Yeah, if you haven't done the absentee thing, the roads aren't too bad. Go on and get out there and vote.
That's right. We've got a couple of minutes for upcoming events. Phil, why don't you share some of the high points with us?
We do. Tonight is the North Idaho CASA, C-A-S-A, Purse Party. Everyone's invited to attend. It's from 4 to 7 p.m. at the winery. You can bid on and win designer handbags and gently used purses to benefit the CASA. And otherwise, the middle of the week here is quieting down as we're in fall, but by the weekend, things get busy again, as it always does around here.
Yes, and time to think skiing. I think there are a couple of skiing events this weekend.
Yeah, what are they?
The ski swap.
The ski swap.
County. Yes.
It's not on here. Tell us about the ski swap.
Well, that's coming up this weekend. If you've got items that you want to contribute, bring them in Friday, and Saturday morning they'll be opening the doors for people to go ahead and get gently used equipment.
That's always good. Again, usually you get there early because it will sell out pretty quick.
That's
that,
right.
That time already.
I know it. We get snow, and next thing you have the ski swap.
The annual harvest dinner at the Memorial Community Center takes place on the 10th. The evening begins at 5:30 p.m. with a no-host bar, complimentary appetizers, and a fun-filled bucket of bucket raffles featuring locally crafted and homemade items.
All right, and one last interesting item, Phil.
Huh. I think it's hopes that either we get more snow so that we can go out and do a little early cross-country skiing, you know, or maybe if it clears up a little, because there are still some fall colors. It's still the larch needles falling on the snow on the driveway were just absolutely magical.
They are beautiful. Well, with that, we're going to call it a day, and we'll look forward to talking with you all next week.
And I think we have queued up a song I requested Julie play coming back from my 40th reunion. Lots of stuff running through my head.